A lot of people say like, oh, the financial advisor, that industry is, you know, done on a Bitcoin standard. I partly actually agree with a lot of people.
It's a pretty fringe case that you simply don't have the ability, because I can tell you at the Bitcoin way, we're training 80-year-olds. I mean, quite literally running their own node in cold storage, air-gapped, open source hardware wallets.
Any asset going through probate is not private. It's in the public domain. And for Bitcoiners, that's mostly unpreferable.
You help people think proactively about this in a way that most financial advisors don't.
I mean, we already saw it with the block size wars. Like, there's going to be something in the future, whether it's quantum computing, whatever else, I don't know.
I think that might be the most unpopular opinion you could have shared. I think you are going to piss the most people off with that opinion.
The biggest question I get is the custody, inheritance, estate planning, you know, aspect. And just how do we solve for this?
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, we have Jacob Phelps of Strong Wealth. So Jacob is a hardcore Bitcoiner and, funny enough, a financial advisor at Strong Wealth. Really smart guy. This is a very practical episode. We talk about estate planning. We talk about the tax implications of being a Bitcoiner, of mining, which is a very interesting thing that you should stick around for at the end. We talk about 401ks, IRAs, a lot of these common questions that Bitcoiners are trying to sort through. And at the very end, I ask him for an unpopular opinion that he has, and this one's going to blow you away. I think this is by far the most unpopular opinion that I've had on my show. So stay tuned to the end. I think you'll really enjoy it. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Jacob here with me. Jacob, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Happy to be on, happy to have a conversation.
Yeah, we've spent a lot of time talking the last couple of weeks. So for everyone listening, Jacob and I met in Vegas very briefly a couple months back. Didn't really get a chance to chat then, and scheduled like a 30-minute call a couple of weeks ago just to sort of, acquaint ourselves with one another, and it turned into like a 90-minute conversation. And now we're starting this recording like 30 minutes late because we were chatting. So I think this is going to be a very fun conversation. So Jacob, you are you're a Bitcoiner and you're a financial advisor. And I think for a lot of people, they try to figure out like what role does Bitcoin play in, you know, in a portfolio. Obviously, you know me, I think of Bitcoin as money, as the ultimate savings technology. But there are a lot of people who I do think have very legitimate questions. And I am curious, from your perspective, what is the most common question that you receive as a financial advisor, predominantly serving Bitcoiners?
Yeah, it really centers around the inheritance, custody, and estate aspect of Bitcoin. And, you know, really what that gets to is that, okay, you know, yeah, I own Bitcoin in some form or fashion now, and that's great. But sometimes that's not the best way to own Bitcoin, right? Even if it's self-custody, maybe you're not self-custody, right? Maybe it's on an exchange and it shouldn't be on an exchange, or at the very least, it shouldn't be on, you know, maybe a certain type of exchange. And so, that really kind of does carry into all of the rest of that, right? So what we normally see is, okay, we have a custody conversation. How should you actually hold this Bitcoin? And we want that way that you're holding it to be something that you're comfortable with. And really what I talk through with clients is, because we prefer clients to self-custody. We think that, you know, that's both a burden and a privilege to self-custody, right? It's a privilege. We have the ability to do so, but it is a burden in that we are fully responsible for the Bitcoin that we own. And so with that burden and privilege, then what we talk about is just this aspect that, okay, if we are going to make the decision to self-custody our Bitcoin, we have to have both the willingness and the ability to do so. If either one of those things isn't true, then we probably need to look at alternatives. If you don't have the willingness, or you just don't have the technical ability to actually do that and do that securely and safely across time, then we need to look at alternatives. But we do try to focus on the self-custodial aspect. And then from that, again, it's really this, okay, how do we own it now? But also, how do we want it, you know, how does it get to the people we want it to get to when we pass away? Because again, if our Bitcoin dies with us, that's probably not a great outcome for not only us, but the people we want it to get to, right? And so that's really the biggest thing is just, okay, how are we owning that Bitcoin now? Is that the appropriate? Is that the best way to do it? And then also that inheritance aspect, how does it get to, you know, these people that we want it to get to? And, you know, I know, like, you know, we look at, you know, the collaborative providers and a lot of other, you know, kind of companies in the space, they'll say, oh, we have these inheritance protocols. And they'll say, yeah, you know, that covers you, right? Like, all right, we got an inheritance protocol and you can get your Bitcoin to the people it needs to get to from there. And, you know, that is good. An inheritance protocol is good. It's a good thing to have. But it really only does solve one half of the inheritance problem. And so really what that gets to is, you know, how do we think about ownership of Bitcoin? And the way we think about it is there's really two legs to it. So the first one is the possession aspect. So in order to own an asset, we have to possess it. So with Bitcoin, that's the private keys, right? Or, you know, private keys, multiple, depending on how the setup works. And that's what those inheritance protocols really solve for, is that possession aspect, which is why that's important, right? Yeah, our beneficiaries have to be able to access the private keys. If they can't, then okay, like that Bitcoin is likely lost. But the other aspect is the legal title aspect. And so that's the thing that we kind of bring together to make a full inheritance protocol for our clients and answer kind of that question of, okay, how does this get to, you know, who we want it to get to? And the legal title aspect, there's many ways that can be solved. Most of them are fairly simple, but the base premise here is that even though Bitcoin is a digital bearer asset, in most jurisdictions, it's not really covered by existing bearer asset laws like gold is, where kind of possession and legal title are one and the same. So if you possess the thing, you also have legal title of it. Furthermore, sometimes you don't really want that Bitcoin maybe to directly go to your beneficiaries. And so we can solve for legal title, but then also solve for this, okay, yeah, you've got minor children, right? You've got a couple kids and they're, you know, 6, 8, and 10. Like if you were to die tomorrow, you probably, you know, both you and let's say you're married, your spouse, you both die tomorrow. You probably don't want your kids to have full access to all your Bitcoin at those ages. And so that's part of what the legal title side of it can also solve for as well, is that, hey, okay, yeah, we're going to solve for the possession. So we're going to make sure that your kids can access the private keys to your Bitcoin. That's important, or even your spouse. But also solve for that other portion that says, okay, we want to make sure that, yes, they legally own that as well, and do that with a mechanism that maybe allows for a little bit more flexibility upon when they own that, not necessarily just upon your death. And so, that's the biggest thing that a lot of the folks come to us for, is kind of solving for that. And, you know, the way I kind of think through it or frame it too is, you know, if all we have, or all we're solving for, I should say, is the possession aspect with the inheritance piece of it, it's kind of like a one leg stool, right? Like, all right, we got the stool and there's one leg under the possession. And it's like, you know, that could topple over pretty easily. Versus if we have both the legal title and the possession, we've now at least got a couple legs on there, or in a 2D image, we have a triangle, which is a much more secure way, or much more at least less tip overable way to solve for the inheritance aspect of Bitcoin. And so, yeah, that really is the big thing. And, you know, to this point, you know, you bring up like Bitcoin financial advisors, like, you know, a lot of people say like, oh, the financial advisor, that industry is, you know, done on a Bitcoin standard. And I partly actually agree with a lot of people on that. I do think that there is, you know, a lot of folks in my business that, yeah, if we really were on a Bitcoin standard, they wouldn't necessarily have a job unless they're really providing, you know, value, right? They're providing Bitcoin denominated alpha. So, okay, hey, yeah, we can actually generate returns above and beyond holding Bitcoin. Otherwise, we're just going to save in Bitcoin, right? That's kind of one of the big premises, is we now have the ability to just save instead of being forced to invest. But my argument against that is, I mean, that's still just one part of your financial life. Like, okay, great, you solve for the saving, maybe you still invest or don't invest, whatever, but there's many other aspects of your financial life. This estate planning is one of them, the tax planning, you know, risk management, so insurance, all that other sort of stuff. There's all these other aspects of your financial life that, you know, still need to be addressed. And, you know, you might want to do that yourself, and that's fine. But that is part of where financial planners, financial advisors can still be helpful, even on a Bitcoin standard. And above and beyond that, if you want to go back to traditionally what financial advisors did, you know, it really truly was not the mindset that so many have now, where it's just kind of buy and hold passive index, we'll charge you a fee and, you know, go on your way. No, it's actually generating returns above and beyond what you can do yourself. And so there will still be a desire, at least for that, for some people in some sort of, you know, Bitcoin standard type world. So, but it is still a interesting cognitive dissonance for me personally, because I'm a fairly hardcore Bitcoiner, I would say. And so there is this aspect of like, all right, what am I doing here? But that to me is the fun of what I am doing, is that I feel like I can really see both sides clearly, and then I can still do my best to try to provide value to people through that in ways that, you know, are truly valuable to them. So that was a really long answer, but the short of it is, the biggest question I get is the custody, inheritance, estate planning, you know, aspect. And just how do we solve for this when we own Bitcoin, and especially a lot of our clients, a significant amount of their assets are in Bitcoin. So it is something that we need to cover. It's not just like, oh, you know, I own, you know, $10,000 worth of Bitcoin, but got a whole ton of assets over here. Like, no, it might be, you know, 50%+ of their investable net worth. And that's something that, yeah, we need to make sure we prepare for.
Yeah, no, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I got a few comments. Two of them at least are, I think, self-serving. So first of all, I completely agree with you. You need the ability and the willingness to learn self-custody. I think that the ability is, it's a pretty fringe case that you simply don't have the ability, because I can tell you, at the Bitcoin way, we're training 80-year-olds. I mean, quite literally running their own node in cold storage, air-gapped, open source hardware wallets, and they've got it figured out. I think that the trick is, to your other point, is I think that the willingness needs to be there. And I think if we as Bitcoiners can help impart this knowledge and this understanding of the importance of what it means to be able to be self-sovereign financially and to hold the keys to your wealth, I think that's, you know, once that switch is flipped, it's very hard to go back and imagine trusting someone else, especially when you've seen exchanges fail and, you know, all the counterparty risk in the space and that. And the second thing is, you know, I agree with you. Like, one of the more challenging things that we have dealt clients with is you know, inheritance planning. And we think it's important. Obviously, when you have like younger children, for example, it's, you know, you're not going to probably teach a 7-year-old to, send and sign transactions and how to recover a wallet and everything. But for many, there it really does come down to, I think, this determination to be self-sovereign, and then to train those who are affected by your death on how to properly take custody of the Bitcoin that is due to them. I think with I guess I'm a little curious. You mentioned there are sort of a few ways you could potentially go about this, the title aspect, so like legal ownership, because possession is just the ability to transfer, to for me to own it one day I die, and my wife or kids to own it the next day, and to like be able to do something with it. With possession, like, what are the typical arrangements that you help your clients think through? Like, what if someone's like, okay, is it a matter of the right language in, you know, a will? Is it the right structure of a trust? Like, how do you generally approach that?
Yeah. So, I mean, first caveat, I'm not a lawyer. So we help clients do this. We're not actually the ones doing it. So we're always referring out to attorneys, and we do have Bitcoiner attorneys that we can refer to too, which is nice. But yeah, the general idea is, so there's three ways that assets pass to someone else upon your death. And this is going to apply to, you know, the legal title portion of it is, okay, how do we then communicate that legal title to them? And so those three ways are by law, contract, and then probate. And so I'll start from the bottom up, but probate is a public court process. So probate is, okay, you have assets, you die, those assets need to go somewhere. You don't have the where they're going determined by some sort of contract or some sort of law. And so by default, then, those assets will go through probate. Probate is a public process, right? So it's going through the probate court. So that goes on a public record if we're going through probate. And so for the most part, especially in the idea of a self-sovereign Bitcoiner, what we're trying to do is avoid those assets going through probate, right? So say, hey, we don't want our Bitcoin to go through a probate court because now we're just creating a honeypot for our beneficiaries, right? Like, and if you've ever, you know, some people have went through this, you have a parent die and all of a sudden you're getting all these real estate agents calling you saying, hey, like we can help you sell your parents' house. And you're like, well, how in the world did you even know that the house is for sale? It's because it went through the probate court. So it went on a public record. Real estate agents will check that. And then they can see, okay, yeah, here's the executor of the estate. We'll contact them and say, we can help them sell the house. And so, you know, it's not like you can just go on Google and see probate records. For the most part, you still got to go through the courthouse and all that sort of stuff. But the premise being that any asset going through probate is not private. It's in the public domain. And for Bitcoiners, that's mostly unpreferable. And so really then what we're saying is, how can we solve this? How can we solve for this legal title aspect outside of going through the probate court? And to the point of, okay, like a will, all that, a will goes through probate. So if all you have is Bitcoin isn't being included in a will, it's going to go through the probate process. Now that's, again, that's not bad, right? Because then at the very least, your wishes still should be followed through the will, right? So if you say, hey, you know, I've got this Bitcoin and I want the Bitcoin to be split equally to my children. Okay, that very likely will still happen. Now, of course, you know, going through the probate court, there's always a chance that it might not. That's, you know, we've heard about those things before that, oh yeah, there is a contested estate. Yeah, a lot of times that happens with the probatable assets. So if all you have is a will, that's good because it still is establishing that legal title kind of lineage. Okay, hey, I owned it. I now want it to go here. That's better than having nothing. Because if you have nothing, if you don't have a will, you don't have anything, then guess who gets to decide where those assets go? The probate court. Now, most of the time, it's not like they're just going to be like, oh yeah, we're going to give it to Johnny down the street. Like, yeah, if you have kids, you have a spouse, like, yeah, it's very likely it would go to them. But the premise is that you don't really get to have that control over it as you otherwise would. And so the way we encourage clients, especially if they're more private, they want to be more self-sovereign, is to try and capture Bitcoin by some sort of law or by some sort of contract. And so simple examples of, you know, by law, by contract, law would be joint ownership of an asset. So if you have a bank account, you have just a regular investment account, brokerage account, and let's say that's you and your spouse, so you and your wife own the account jointly. When you passes away, by default, it just goes to the other spouse. There's really nothing more that needs to be done. It's not a probatable asset that, you know, okay, hey, this has to go through. Nope, it just goes to them. By contract, a simple example of that is a beneficiary designation. So transfer on death, payable on death, that sort of thing. That's just a very simple legal contract that is saying, hey, I've died. I want these assets to go to this person or to these people. Again, that now we're avoiding probate because we have a very simple legal contract that establishes that legal title lineage. So, okay, it was here. Now it goes here. And so out of those two options, you certainly could do something to have joint ownership of Bitcoin, especially like if you're just holding it on an exchange or doing like some sort of collaborative custody even sometimes, or certainly like multi-institution, multi-sig, you can just kind of do that just like you can a bank account. Name a beneficiary, there it goes. For us, that it still isn't always preferable, especially in the case of, yeah, you have minor children. And the reason for that is a beneficiary designation, while it does establish, okay, it goes to the kids, it's still going to go to them, you know, right when you die, right? Or if you and your spouse die at the same time, right when you both die. And yeah, to your point, if you have a 7-year-old kid, probably don't want that to happen necessarily. That might not be the best outcome for them. And so a lot of times then it's doing and putting in place or updating an existing revocable living trust to basically have the Bitcoin in that trust. So that trust will now, okay, we get Bitcoin into the trust. There's a couple of different ways that can happen, but you know, that's the primary thing we want to focus on is getting Bitcoin into the trust. Once it's in the trust, that's a type of legal contract. So we're avoiding probate by doing that. and then the benefit of a trust over just like a simple beneficiary designation, transfer on death, payable on death, all that sort of stuff, or even joint ownership, is that then we can have delineation of when those distributions happen. So instead of, okay, me and my spouse died, goes to our kids immediately, it can be me and my spouse died and my kids don't get to access this until 18. And maybe that's just a percentage, right? So at 18, they can have 20% of whatever's in the trust. At 21, they can have another 25%. At 25, they can have the full balance or whatever. There's many different ways you can structure it. You can get very, very delineative with how that goes to them, though.
How do you think about that, though? If, you know, if you say at different ages, I want them to have different amounts and you're in self-custody, mm-hmm. And you don't want to set up a separate wallet, you know, for each incremental age and try to, manage the balances and the UTXOs in each of those wallets, is it just kind of a complicated thing that you've got to set up? I assume it'd be much easier just to say, upon my death, my adult children, you know, get access to the private keys and can access that versus like trying to, you know, split it up at various ages.
Yeah. So it really, I mean, you can make it complicated like that if you want to. So you can make it, okay, yeah, upon my death, now we're going to establish, you know, three separate wallets for each of my three kids, right? Most of the time I just say, hey, if you want to do that now, there's many different ways you can go about it. You could, you know, have a passphrase, right? So, okay, I have one passphrase wallet for kid one, another passphrase wallet for kid two, all that. To me, that makes things a little bit more complicated, especially that, okay, you're no longer here. So some sort of successor trustee is now managing the trust. So someone you've nominated is now managing that trust. So I can make things a little more complicated just because now you've got more information you've really got to maintain. So, you know, what I normally say is, okay, it either can be a segregated derivation path under the same master key for each child, or if you would really want to segregate it out and give them some control, at least in the future, you could always do child seeds as well. So use BIP85, generate some child seeds, do that for each kid. You still have the same master seed up top that can be passphrased, whatever else, multi-sig, that sort of thing. I think those kind of solve for that better, but it can also just be as simple as, here, you know, it's in this wallet, you know, you have private keys associated with that wallet. And okay, it just, that balance is going to grow across time. The trustee, their job is really managing that Bitcoin in that wallet. And then they're just going to distribute out to the kids as necessary in the future. And so that's where like you can hedge it and you can put it in the structures if you want to now or upon your death or whatever. But a much simpler solution is just leave it put. And the successor trustee will just distribute to the children and, you know, they can do what they want from there. They can continue to hold it in Bitcoin. They can, you know, sell it and do whatever else with it. But at the very least, those transfers will happen to them. And again, this is some of the benefit of the trust structure, too, is that you can actually have some stipulations around how those distributions happen as far as, hey, like, yeah, if you're going to take a distribution, it has to stay in Bitcoin, right? There's ways that you can kind of make that happen in different trust structures that you can make that happen within, I should say. And so you can have some of that granularity in there as well that say, hey, yeah, you got to continue to hold that in Bitcoin if you're going to take a distribution. But to the point, yeah, it doesn't have to be complicated if you don't want it to be. That's kind of the nice thing with trusts is, That's the discretion you have. You can make it as simple or as, you know, complex as you want to make it. The base premise here is getting it into that trust so that that asset is now flowing through to your beneficiaries by a legal contract, avoiding probate. That's a much more private way for that Bitcoin to get to them versus going through probate or, you know, even if we don't have a will that it says it, even outside of that, and then the court gets to decide.
So major hypothetical here. Hypothetically, someone has a bunch of no KYC Bitcoin and they do not want to make the probate court or any other authority that might be involved in, addressing how assets flow upon death. I'm not clear on like the mechanism by which assets are presented to the probate court or to others. presumably you've got no KYC Bitcoin. If you've trained your adult kids or your spouse or what have you, hey, upon my death, here's how you access that Bitcoin. Again, hypothetically, there's no real way for that to be brought into the equation. The rest of sort of your KYC'd assets, so like your house, you can't run from your, you know, Schwab checking account or your, you know, Fidelity, you know, anything like TradFi is, you know, it's going to be identified as something that needs to be addressed. Is the risk associated with what I'm describing here for like non-KYC Bitcoin simply you need to make, like, it's the onus is on you to make sure that your spouse, your kids, whoever knows how to access that Bitcoin upon your death. Is that sort of it?
No, the bigger risk is that somehow that does become found out, right? Because basically if you're saying, hey, you're not, and to be very clear, a trust is, trust doesn't go through probate court. It's not a public document. If you have a trust, it's you have a copy, your attorney has a copy, and whoever else you want has a copy. Those are the only people that are going to know about any Bitcoin in that trust. So as far as like KYCing it, like you're really not, right? Because there's nothing still that's tying you to that. Even upon your death, like, okay, the successor trustee is going to manage it. But that doesn't mean it's KYC'd. Like it doesn't have to go to an exchange. You can put non-KYC Bitcoin into a trust and it can stay non-KYC through that process. Again, that's the benefit, the privacy that comes with a trust versus going through the probate. But if you're trying to say, hey, I just don't want anything with any of this. I don't want to deal with any of this at all. I just want them to get the Bitcoin because theoretically nobody knows about it besides them. The risk then is to those beneficiaries, to your spouse, to your children, you're opening them up to a legal liability because if that were ever to be found out, and it's likely that it could, right? So let's use an example. You don't put your Bitcoin in a trust, you don't include it in the will, you just say, hey, this is going to be outside of all the probate estate, right? Okay, that's great. Your kids there, you train them, they can get possession so they can access the Bitcoin. They then, you know, at some point in the future say, okay, I want to buy a house and I want to use the Bitcoin as the down payment or to buy it in full. Okay, the bank's going to be like, where did this Bitcoin come from? All right, if you're taking a loan, right? If you're not and you're just buying it in whole, it's a different story. But if you're taking a loan, they're going to be like, where did this Bitcoin come from? And you're going to say, well, I inherited it from my dad. They're like, okay, where's the record for that? There is none, right? Like if you have a trust, you can say, okay, here's kind of that path and how that flowed. Okay, there you go. But if there is none, all of a sudden it's like, whoa, what in the world happened here? Now, granted, a lender, like, is it likely they're going to then report that, right? No, probably not, but maybe they're going to be a little bit more wary about it. And okay, yeah, maybe we can't use these assets to buy the home or whatever. And so that's again why, go ahead.
So if you had a and so with like the trust, you don't have to divulge how much Bitcoin you have. You just have to divulge, like you say, my Bitcoin stack basically is what exists in this trust, because if you're earning in Bitcoin, if you're buying more, it's not like you're updating. It's not sitting there as like a bank account, right? Like, how is it actually like recorded and documented within the trust? Does that question even make sense?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And so there's a few ways that I've seen attorneys account for that. The simplest one is they'll just have a digital asset clause within the trust itself. Most of the time, digital assets, when they have that clause in the trust, it's more specific to like online accounts. So like, okay, yeah, you can log into my bank account or have access to my, you know, X password, whatever. That's what it means by digital assets. But you can just kind of curate that digital asset clause a little bit more and specifically include Bitcoin in that. So it says, you know, any digital assets, including Bitcoin with that. That's a very simple way to do that. And then, yeah, really nothing is divulged. A lot of the time what I talk to with clients on this, though, is I prefer if we would list out the XPUBs of the Bitcoin that you're holding. So the balance isn't going to be in the document directly. The XPUBs would. Again, there's, okay, we're divulging some information from that. But again, the trust document is you, attorney, your spouse, whoever else, right? Like nobody else should really be seeing that or getting access to it. And so with the XPubs, we're not divulging the private keys, but we are at least saying, here's where all the Bitcoin is. And so, you know, to me, that's just kind of like a nice, I guess, catch-all. That's probably not a great way to say it, but basically saying like, okay, even if you've trained your beneficiaries, even if we've solved for the possession and they know where everything is, the XPubs and the trust are specifically delineating what Bitcoin is in the trust itself. And so then we know, okay, here's what we need to be, looking for, worried about, and moving that Bitcoin to others. And this is especially helpful in the event of the, beneficiaries being minor children, because then you're going to have a successor trustee. The kids themselves aren't going to be able to do it. So the successor trustee is going to know specifically what Bitcoin they're responsible for managing. There's different ways, again, you can go about getting those XPubs in there. But most of the time it's through like an addendum type document, which also makes it nice because then, okay, yeah, maybe change your wallet structure across time, maybe change your wallet in general, use different private keys so you have a different XPub. Then we don't have to go back and update the trust in whole. We can just update that addendum document that says these new XPubs, right? So it's not like a whole big ordeal to have to then go and change the trust itself. So yes, like I said, is there some privacy trade-off to that? Yes. Like, I'm not saying there's not, but to me it's fairly minimal because of how trusts are, structured and being private in and of themselves.
Got it. Okay. So let's move on. We spent 30 minutes on estate planning. I think that's probably very helpful for a lot of people to get them thinking. We get a lot of questions, and part of the reason I was very excited to get to meet you, and I had Mitch on the show a while ago, your business partner. We had a lot of questions about IRAs, 401ks, or retirement accounts. Should I, sell off the assets in my IRA so I can buy in self-custody Bitcoin? Is there a path for like a self-directed IRA where I can self-custody Bitcoin? We have, people who if they do feel like they're trapped in like a TradFi, with TradFi options, should I be allocating the ETFs? Maybe just sort of lay out what you typically, like, what do people come to you for when it comes to retirement planning? And how do you generally sort through some of these topics and questions?
Yeah. Yeah. So specifically with the IRAs, it really is a matter of personal preference. We've got plentiful options now, which is really nice, right? We can go, a purely self-custodied route, right? So we can have a self-directed IRA account, and within that self-directed IRA account, we can hold the Bitcoin through some sort of self-custody mechanism. Now, there is a few things to be aware of when we do that, because there really isn't super definitive guidance from the IRS about what is okay and what's not okay as far as that goes. So meaning like, okay, if I'm going to have a self-directed IRA, can I just have a single private key that I hold? That may not be kosher. There was, I forget the ruling, but it was probably 3-4 years ago now, that maybe made it seem like that might not be kosher. And that actually would be construed as a distribution from the IRA if you did that, which then you would owe taxes and penalties on if you did that. But that's kind of why, we see some companies in the space where it'll be a collaborative setup where you hold a key, the collaborative company holds a key and some trust company holds a third key. That is fairly well covered that, yeah, that works just fine, because really what the IRS is worried about or wants to cover with that specific mechanism is they need to have some way to verify the assets that are in the IRA. And, if the self-directed company that you're working with is doing something that they can legitimately verify it, it's not just based on self-reporting, they much prefer that versus you're just telling a self-directed, IRA company, oh yeah, I own this much Bitcoin. Like, and there's really no way for them to verify it. That's kind of where the gray area comes in. So that's where it's like, okay, if we want to do that, we got to be very careful about how we structure that.
So it sounds to me like the IRS thinks that Bitcoin is money and not an investment. That's what I just heard. So the IRS understands Bitcoin better than most others, it appears. That's interesting.
Yeah. I, the president, they said it was actually with gold self-directed IRAs, but it's just if you take what they, and this was, when I say they said it, there's just basically a case that was settled that applied to a gold self-directed IRA that actually kind of went against some of the previous kind of rulings about this sort of stuff. And so that's where the gray area comes in, is it's like all of a sudden they're doing something different than what historically kind of been done in those cases. And that's where it's like, okay, wait, is this actually kosher to do a fully self-custody, self-directed IRA or not? And we just don't have guidance.
So it's your understanding of the ruling then, is it like, as it relates to gold, just as an analog for this, is if you want to convert to self-directed and you want to basically sell all the assets you have there for gold, and you want to take possession of physical gold, that's where the challenge is, because they can't audit and evaluate how much do you actually have. You could lie about it or whatever.
Right.
I mean, to me, I don't like the digital gold analogy. I think is useful at times, but it's not, doesn't explain Bitcoin. But for in this particular case, I would imagine that the IRS and any regulatory authorities would perceive Bitcoin to be very much like gold in that, because it's a bearer asset like physical gold, you'd be in the same boat, and it might not work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think now that I remember, I think the case is it's McNulty versus, I think it was maybe in Texas it happened. So I mean, if you want to look it up, folks could, but. Yeah, to the premise though, like, so that's an option, right? But that's where it kind of comes down to personal preference. Like, if we're going to own those assets in the IRA, do you really want to go through all that work? Or, you know, that's where I say there's nice things we can do now. Like Fidelity, just a couple of months ago, not in every state, but in most states, you can hold spot Bitcoin on their platform, right? So you can log into Fidelity, buy spot Bitcoin within an IRA. So it's not great, right? It's not self-custody, but then you're at least not having the ETF and you're not having to pay the, you know, the minor fee that an ETF involves along the way. You're truly holding spot. So that can be another really good option. And then even the ETF can be a good option, because sure, is there a fee involved? And sure, does, you know, in a theoretical world, the price of the ETF can fluctuate from the actual price of Bitcoin. Now that fluctuation is normally minimal. But like, okay, there could be differences across time there. It really comes down to, again, what the specific goals of that client are, you know, in both now and over the long term. Because if we're going to be in a scenario where, you know, you're going to keep those assets within the IRA, which I'll get to, okay, what if I just want to take them out? What are the implications there in a minute? But if we're going to keep them within the IRA, Roth IRA, 401k structure, but at some point in the future, maybe we want to do something that's not Bitcoin, which I know for a lot of people is heretical, right? Like, great, why would you own anything else but Bitcoin? But some people want to, right? Like even in the event of you want to hold MSTR, right? Or something like that, like a Bitcoin adjacent, a Bitcoin treasury company. Then a lot of times it can just make sense to not go the self-directed route, because then it makes it real easy to make those changes. Because, okay, if we go the self-directed route, and then at some point in the future, we do want to make a change, that can be a process for that to actually happen. And it's not necessarily a fun process, and it's a timely process too. You know, we've had examples of clients that had, you know, more self-directed Bitcoin. And instead of just being able, like if I was in an IRA holding the ETF, sell the ETF and buy whatever else, they have to, okay, sell it out of the self-directed IRA, transfer it from self-directed to some sort of regular IRA at one of the big custodians. That can take weeks, right? And we know what Bitcoin can do in the matter of weeks. And all of a sudden you've missed out on price appreciation, which, you know, over the long term, that probably doesn't matter, but it's still psychologically difficult to handle. And so that's part of the consideration there too, is just, you know, what clients kind of want. And then to the point of like, yeah, okay, what if we just want to get it out of the Roth and IRA structures? You can do that, right? So, I mean, your IRA assets, you can do whatever with. It's just, you know, if you do take those out before that 59 and a half age, then you're going to have some sort of penalty that you pay on that. So it's a 10% penalty. If it's a traditional IRA, it's pretty much a 10% penalty on everything that's in that account. For, you know, there's some exceptions, but it's pretty much everything in there. If it's a Roth IRA, your basis, so whatever you contributed to that account, so contribute $5,000 for 5 years, you have a $25,000 basis. Say over that time, you had it in Bitcoin, it grows to $50,000. If then you take everything out of the Roth IRA and you take pure self-custody, you're going to pay a 10% penalty on that $25,000 of growth. The $25,000 of basis, you won't have to pay a penalty on. And with the Roth, the nice thing is you also won't have to pay taxes on that because you already paid the taxes in the account. But if it's in a traditional IRA, you're going to pay both a 10% penalty and income taxes on that because you've got a tax deduction when you put that into the account up front. So you can always take those out. It's just a matter of, okay, like, do I want to take that income tax hit, that penalty hit, and all that sort of stuff? And sometimes that can make sense. You know, my mindset is, you know, if you really want to be, all right, I just want to be self-sovereign. I don't want to have anything in the fiat trap buckets. Okay, then this is your option. Like, I mean, don't get me wrong. There's some other kind of creative techniques that we can massage to get, you know, maybe some of that out without paying some of those penalties. But by and large, that's going to be the route that you have to take. And so in my mind, you know, what I get to is like, okay, if we're holding the ETF or we're holding quasi self-custody Bitcoin in an IRA, and we want to take it all out to just continue to self-custody that Bitcoin, that doesn't really make sense. Like, you're just paying a 10% penalty for really no reason in my mind. Again, if you're really like, well, I want privacy, I want self-sovereignty, all that sort of stuff. Okay, great. Then this is the cost of you gaining that after putting those assets into the account. But the base premise is you can't always take them out. It's just you're going to owe taxes and penalties on it if you were to do so.
Okay. So you brought it up. I feel like every podcast I have to address this topic. You mentioned treasury companies, and I'm curious if that is so. Retirement accounts aside, if you've got clients who, you know, save in Bitcoin, but maybe they want to invest, you know, some portion of their wealth elsewhere, are treasury companies, are they vehicles that you see useful for cash flow? Do you see them as, you know, legitimate speculative plays for people who are looking to, you know, have some fun and try out performing Bitcoin, you know, with a smaller portion of their portfolio? How do you think about them?
Yeah, more of the latter. I think what treasury companies are doing is interesting. And especially MicroStrategy, just that there is some sort of history there versus this new wave of all these new treasury companies. There really isn't history to say, okay, we've seen kind of what's happened with them through a bear market. And even with MicroStrategy themselves, I mean, they're doing a lot of stuff now that they weren't doing prior to this previous bear market. Which, again, people, we could go back and forth on our cycle, it's going to continue or not. We don't know at the end of the day. All we have is history that shows that they do happen. And so, okay, we can have some reasonable assumption that they'll happen again in the future. And so to me, that's really the risk with them, is that the new ones are unproven. We don't know what happens in those things. Even MicroStrategy, where you could say, well, it was proven through a cycle, things are kind of different now in how they're actually operating the company itself. And so to me, it is unproven. And so that's where I get to, to me, it's more speculative. All right, you want to, you know, again, try to outperform Bitcoin, or you just want to support these companies because you think it's cool what they're doing, right? Like, oh yeah, they're adopting Bitcoin, all that. Then great. But yeah, it probably should be, you know, a smaller portion of your investable assets versus, you know, okay, yeah, I'm just going to go all into MicroStrategy because, yeah, it's going to outperform Bitcoin and I just want the performance, right? And so that's where, yeah, a lot of times it's just kind of guardrail systems. Like, if this is something you want to do, let's set an allocation target, let's rebalance to that allocation target, you know, at some frequency and time. And then let's also define what, you know, when and what an exit of that position looks like. You know, when would we just say, okay, either take the gains or minimize the losses and get out, or you're just saying, nope, I'm doing this and we're buying and holding. That's all this stuff that we would, you know, define on the front end and say, okay, here's what we're going to do. And then when things come to pass, either that growth or, okay, we're realizing a loss, whatever, then we just execute upon those. That's a much better way to go about it versus, all right, yeah, I'll just, YOLO into the company and whatever happens, happens. Like, and that now you're just in an emotion-based decision, which as much as financial advisors want to say, well, we don't want to make emotional decisions. And so they'll say, yeah, we'll help you not make those. It's like, every decision has emotions involved. We're human beings. Like, we can never fully remove our emotions from any equation. So it's just minimizing the impact of those emotions and making those decisions. So, yeah, you know, I think they're interesting. The companies and themselves and kind of the premise behind them and, you know, what they're doing. If you want to speculate on them, great, but let's just set up the rules around what that looks like and then execute upon that now and into the future.
So I've got a random curiosity for you, since we're talking about sort of the financial planning portion of your work. What percentage of the value that you provide is at Strong Wealth for the average Bitcoin client, do you perceive to be a result resulting from your financial advisory services versus investment management, I guess you might say, versus things like estate planning, tax planning, you talked about like insurance and all these other considerations that are part of one's financial life? Because it seems to me like most people, you know, do a set it and forget it, 60-40 portfolio kind of thing, outside of Bitcoin, obviously. It seems to me like on one hand, you help people think proactively about this in a way that most financial advisors don't, but you're also a hardcore Bitcoiner who probably would generally, whether you advise or just suggest that it's perfectly acceptable for you to just have most of your wealth in Bitcoin. So I'm curious, like, what percentage of the value that you're bringing to the average Bitcoin client, I'll just reframe it for you, do you think is derived from these services related to asset allocation, I guess, maybe more specifically?
Yeah. Well, it depends on the client. Because we've had clients come in that all they have is Bitcoin. I mean, they don't want to do anything else. So in that scenario, that's all just the Bitcoin expertise. That's the technical knowledge on custody. Yeah, there's some of the inheritance and estate planning stuff in there. So that's maybe more of the TradFi type stuff. But a lot of it is, you know, more related to the Bitcoin specific expertise we have versus the traditional financial planning expertise. But I would say that is, it's not a minority as far as like it's a small portion, but it's a minority and it's less than 50% are in that bucket. Most folks come in and they still might have a significant amount of assets in Bitcoin, especially in, you know, as percentage of their net worth. But a lot of times they still do have some other stuff. And so, yeah, like the asset allocation, all that stuff, that is where we can be really helpful. We've developed. So one of the core premises we have in that scenario and in general, too, is you have savings Bitcoin and you have investing Bitcoin. So savings Bitcoin is our cold storage, self-custodial Bitcoin. We're most likely just going to acquire that, buy and hold, and really probably not touch it. Maybe talk about loans down the road if you want to do that. Or maybe we do need to use that to fund a lifestyle in the future at some point. But for the most part, that's just, okay, put it in there. We don't touch it. But from an asset allocation perspective, what never has made sense to me is that you have, you know, this idea that, okay, well, I've got Bitcoin over here, so I shouldn't maybe have it in my investing assets, right? So my traditional assets, stocks, bonds, ETFs, commodities, whatever. What I say is like, no, why? Just because you have it over here, Bitcoin is still a highly performative asset. And so why in the world would we just ignore it within a asset allocation with the, you know, more traditional investments because of that? Like, okay, yeah, are we increasing the exposure to Bitcoin? Sure, maybe. But what we've done is we've created some risk managed models that, well, okay, yeah, we're going to have exposure to Bitcoin when it makes sense to, but we're also going to try to limit the full volatility or the full downside that you might experience if you were just buying and holding Bitcoin. And we're also going to hold other assets along the way as well. So, you know, commodities, gold miners, silvers, silver, that sort of stuff, equities as well, broad-based indexed ETFs. We're really bringing those together to then create a performative investment portfolio. Again, investing Bitcoin. So treating Bitcoin as a performance driver within an investment portfolio. and then say, okay, you still have got your, you know, long-term cold storage Bitcoin, you know, along the way. And one big way we utilize that, back to this retirement piece of it, is one of the TradFi things that I think is still applicable even to Bitcoiners is this idea of, if you are getting close to retirement, you probably want to implement some sort of bucket strategy. And so traditionally, the bucket strategy is you have three buckets: short-term, medium-term, long-term bucket. And really what you're doing is you have a short-term bucket that for the most part should just be cash, which I know some Bitcoiners be like, why would you hold cash? It's like, well, because it still is stable, and we only want to have that cash to cover, you know, a year, 2 years, maybe even more of expenses. And the reason for that is that the biggest risk to the Bitcoiner in retirement is a sequence of returns risk. So what that means is that Bitcoin is a highly, highly volatile asset, highly performative, but also highly volatile. And so a sequence of returns risk means that in your first years of retirement, if you have major drawdowns, then that is, those first years are going to be the most you're ever relying on that portfolio or on your assets to pull from, right? Proportionally, right? So if just a simple example, if you have $1 million and you're spending $100,000 a year, you're spending down 10% of your $1 million every single year. Now, I probably wouldn't recommend that. That's probably too high of a withdrawal rate, but for just simple numbers, it works. $1 million, you're drawing down $100,000 a year. That $1 million is all in Bitcoin. And now all of a sudden, Bitcoin does what it's done historically, has a 70, 80% drawdown. Your $1 million is now worth $300,000, $200,000. So now instead of, oh, we've got 10 years of spending in our investments, we've now got 2 or 3 years. And proportionally, you're drawing, not drawing down 10% every year, you're drawing down, you know, 50%, 60%. Of those assets on an annual basis, right? $100,000 on $200,000 or on $300,000, that sort of thing. And so that's a huge risk to the Bitcoiner. And so that's part of what we will talk through with clients is, how do we manage this risk? And so this is where it comes back to the bucketed strategy. So it still can make sense to have cash on hand. Some Bitcoiners will say, well, just have enough cash to survive a Bitcoin bear market and you're fine. To me, I think the psychology of that is more difficult to execute than not, because many Bitcoiners don't like just holding that much cash. And so that's where alternative strategies that include Bitcoin as a performance asset can come in. So we use those as the middle bucket, right? This kind of medium-term bucket. Hey, we're going to have a portfolio that includes Bitcoin, so we're going to have some performance, so you can kind of still get that dopamine hit, whatever. But you're also going to have the short-term bucket to provide for your immediate-term needs. And we're also going to have the long-term bucket of cold storage Bitcoin savings that hopefully we don't have to touch, or at least we don't have to touch for a very long time down the road. And so that, you know, that's kind of the mind, I guess, the mindset we bring. And in that second bucket, like, it doesn't necessarily need to be other assets. It can be, okay, maybe we just do a hedge strategy, right? All you have is cold storage Bitcoin. All right, well, maybe we utilize that to buy some puts, or to buy, you know, or to go short on perpetual futures, something like that, where we're at least getting some sort of or some portion of your Bitcoin that is price insensitive, meaning that, okay, Bitcoin's going to go up, down, whatever. If it does go down, we're going to have something that's going to protect that downside. So you are minimizing that sequence of returns risk that you're realizing through that. So to bring this back, like, you know, all that I just talked through, that's just a blend of the Bitcoin specific stuff we have and the TradFi stuff, right? The bucket itself is kind of a TradFi thing. And so we'll talk through that with Bitcoiners. But some of the other things, like, okay, hey, yeah, having Bitcoin as a performance asset, or having the long-term bucket be Bitcoin's cold storage, that's more where, yeah, kind of the hardcore Bitcoiner comes out, is like, yeah, I mean, we get it. We understand what Bitcoin is and can represent for you. So I didn't give you a direct answer in the percentage, because I don't know.
It's a hard thing to quantify. I understand. I just didn't know if you had sort of a, if maybe people could, I think it could give you a sense as to like the trajectory of the financial advisory profession, yeah. You know, but again, we're still so early in Bitcoin. I think it'll just be interesting for me to see how this plays out over the next few years as more people wake up to what I perceive, of course, as a hardcore Bitcoiner to be the lack of value that most advisors are bringing to their clients. And they're going to have to find other ways, like, you know, like some of the, you know, things you're talking about. And I think, you know, as you approach retirement, like the challenge I can sympathize with for Bitcoiners is, hey, I'm 65 years old and I am either retired or I'm going to be retired very soon. And I can't stomach a 60% drawdown because like I'm relying on, you know, on that. So I guess maybe the simplest, maybe the most hardcore, but reasonably practical thing you could do is, you know, the cycles have tended to be 4 years. And so you say, I'm going to play it conservative. I'm going to have 4 or 5 years of cash or cash equivalents or whatever on hand. And I'm going to put everything else into cold storage Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And then sell, you know, some of it at highs to replenish that 4 years of cash as I draw it down or what have you. And so you've always got, you know, 4 or 5 years of cash on hand to like fund your life or whatever, but still be allocated as heavily to self-sovereign Bitcoin as possible, I guess would be like the simplest. But you're saying that you could approach it a number of different ways. And there, you know, that might not be what everyone wants to do, especially if they're not going to be all in on Bitcoin.
Yeah. From the perspective of holding 4 and 5 years of cash, I mean, if you're spending $100,000 a year, okay, you've got $400,000 or $500,000 in cash. Like, that's where I get to the point that I think that's a easy thing to say, a much harder thing to do, especially for Bitcoiners, is to truly hold that much.
Yeah.
For that period.
That's fair. I guess kind of what I was thinking was, again, like, I'm just like a self-sovereignty maxi. So like I'm throwing out ideas that I'm not even like, I don't love, but like I look at something like River Financials. You can earn 3.8% on your cash balance at River in Bitcoin. And so you're accumulating Bitcoin. So even if there's a drawdown, you've still been stacking some level of value on top of the cash that you have sitting there. And like that just sort of becomes like your spending account in retirement, for example. And again, I'm not a financial advisor. I'm not recommending. I'm just like trying to piece through, like, you know, it's easy for me to be like, oh, all in on Bitcoin. I'm 36 years old. It's a little harder for me to imagine we're 1% global adoption. I'm 65 and trying to retire. And like, I've worked hard my whole life and now it's time for me to spend. But the math doesn't work on a fiat standard that the world happens to be on. If we have an 80% drawdown tomorrow, like it simply doesn't work. So I sympathize with that as much as I, you know, would love to just be a purist about all of this.
Yeah, that's where theoretical and reality tend to clash for folks. So
yeah,
that's the fun part of what we get to do. And I mean, again, it's not for everybody, right? Like some people might just say like, okay, I'll take that risk. Like I'll take that bet. Like, okay. Or maybe you have so much Bitcoin that even those drawdowns still aren't going to matter, right? Like those are considerations as well. So yeah, like, you know, do you need to do something like this? No, absolutely not. There's nothing that you need to do. It's just, again, our premise is, you know, we're goals-based. What's your goal? Well, I want to not have to work. I want to be financially independent. And so for most of our clients, they are Bitcoiners. So they're, you know, okay, it's not like I'm just going to be sitting on a beach doing nothing, but it's just I want to have the optionality to go and work on a passion project that maybe isn't going to provide income for, you know, maybe even ever, but at least it's still something I can do. That's where some of this stuff gets to, is it's like, okay, well, let's prepare for that as best as we can. Knowing that, yeah, you know, it maybe, you know, it might not work out at the end of the day too. So it's just, that's the unknown of the future. And we're just trying to, as best we can, help educate clients on some of what those unknowns are. Right. As far as like, you might not know it, but we do. And then also just say like, yeah, there's other stuff that we don't. And so we're just going to make the best decision we can at this point in time. And we can, you know, change it or modify it in the future if we need to.
All right. So let's shift gears. If you've got the time, I know we're almost at an hour already, but we were talking offline about some topics to cover. You mentioned tax implications and some potential benefits of mining. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. And I would love to hear your thoughts on this. Is this like a Bitcoin accumulation strategy that you often recommend or at least propose to clients because of the tax benefits? And could you explain some of what those tax benefits are?
Yeah. Yeah. So the big thing is, if you're mining Bitcoin, or I should say specifically, if you are acquiring Bitcoin miners, those miners are a depreciable asset. And so depreciation, it's basically this IRS rule where when you buy an asset, you don't get to write down that asset. Normally, you don't get to write down that asset in the year you buy it. So if you know, if you're a real estate developer, you buy a new property for $10 million, you don't get to deduct $10 million off of your profit for tax purposes. Most of the time, you can only deduct what the depreciation is. And the depreciation, it's basically, they came up with this idea of useful life. So it's basically saying you're acquiring an asset. That asset has some sort of useful life. So how long can you actually use this thing? So miners fall into this bucket. And so useful life of a miner, for the most part, at least with the accountants I talk to, the depreciable life or the useful life of a miner is about 5 years. So that's saying basically like, hey, yeah, you could still run miners above and beyond that, but the normal useful life is around 5 years. So with normal depreciation then, again, if you buy, you buy a miner for $5,000, you don't get to deduct $5,000 off of your profit in your Bitcoin mining business. What you do get to deduct is the depreciation for that year. And so in the simplest way, if you have a miner that has a 5-year useful life, you buy a $5,000 miner, you divide that useful life by the purchase price, you get to deduct $1,000 of depreciation every single year. And so that's kind of what depreciation is in general. But one of the cool things with the depreciation is they actually do, to undo what I just said, especially now with the new tax laws that were just changed with what Trump did, you can actually take up to 100% depreciation in the year you acquire your miners. And so what that means is instead of, okay, $1,000 over 5 years, the useful life, you can actually deduct that full $5,000 in the first year as long as you meet some qualifications around, you know, when the miner was put into service and some other things. But you can take that. And then as long as you meet some other certain stipulations, which is mostly, okay, if you're going to do Bitcoin mining, it has, and you do it as an active business versus a passive business. If you do it as an active business, you can then use that depreciation if it's above and beyond the profit, or above and beyond the revenue that your miners generated to offset other income. So to use an example, let's say right now, you acquire a miner right now, August 6th. If you do that, and then you get that up and running, as soon as you can, you have it running for the last however many months of the year we have. And let's say, you bought it for $5,000, and then through the rest of the year, you generate in US dollars, $3,000 of mining revenue. If you then take that full depreciation, it's called bonus depreciation, you can show a $2,000 loss for tax purposes on your mining business, and that $2,000 loss can offset other income that you are earning, as long, again, as you qualify it as an active entity, which I'm not going to speak to because I'm not a tax expert, but the general gist is you have to spend probably 2 to 3 hours a week working in the business with actual, qualified, like you're not just like sitting, like looking at your payout page or something like that. But as long as
a hosted mine solution then wouldn't apply because it's passive.
It could.
It could.
Yeah.
So, as an example, like we have a good relationship with the guys at Simple Mining. Mm-hmm. If you went and toured their facility in Iowa, just to check on your miner, and it took you a couple of hours to do that, you could qualify that as active engagement in the business.
Probably. Again, I'm not an accountant, so they have weird rules about that, but probably. But to me, it's more like, okay, like, you got to spend time actually like doing your books, as an example. like, okay, that actually does take some time, to convert to US dollars, to make sure everything's accurate, to make sure, okay, I'm going to pay my taxes, whatever. I'm researching a new pool that I want to pay out. Okay, yeah, that's actually valuable. Like, it's going to impact the revenue of your business, that sort of stuff. So there's things you can do. Again, I don't like to get into the specifics here because I'm not the accountant, but there is ways, even with a hosted setup, even though it seems like it should probably be passive, you can still meet the active business guidelines to have this mechanism. And so, again, that's the big benefit from the tax perspective, is that you have the potential to offset other income if you run the entity appropriately, if you structure it appropriately. Even if, let's say, you don't meet the active guidelines, you can still take that full depreciation. All it's going to do is, okay, in that same scenario, instead of having a $2,000 loss, you're just going to show $0 of income on the business. So, cool, you got $3,000 of profit free, and then that excess depreciation, the excess $2,000 in my example, would just carry forward to the next year and offset that income in the next year. Again, you couldn't offset other income, but you can offset future income. That gets carried forward. I think it's for 5 years. Maybe it's indefinite. I can't remember off the top of my head. But so that's one big benefit, is the tax benefit. The second big benefit is, when you're mining, you're acquiring Bitcoin at a lower price than the going market rate. So, and that price you're acquiring it at really is dependent upon what your cost of power is. So most of the time it's just electricity, but could be natural gas, whatever else. The lower you can acquire power, the lower the cost to actually produce a Bitcoin is. And so, yeah, like with the guys at, Simple, we're at 115,000 today, maybe that means that you could acquire Bitcoin at $90,000, $80,000 today. So that's the other big benefit, is that you're able to acquire Bitcoin lower because the cost of actually doing that, so running the miners themselves, paying for the electricity, allows you to do so. That's another big benefit, is, okay, price appreciation, whatever. The third big benefit is, there is an opportunity to outperform just hodling Bitcoin. And that opportunity comes from the fact that the revenue generated by miners, in a very simple way, is basically determined by hash price. So hash price is just something that says, okay, per hash. So every time your miner is making a guess to solve the mining problem, every time it's making that hash price is saying you have an expected amount of revenue that can be generated. And normally this is denominated in terahash or petahash. So, bunch of hashes. But so it's taking into account the current price of Bitcoin, the current block reward, the average transaction fees over the last 30 days, and the current network difficulty. And so for miners. And so the opportunity then is that what we see historically with hash price is that it lags the price of Bitcoin. So if Bitcoin has a crazy high run up, hash price will eventually catch up. It will actually, catch up to that, but there'll be a lag to that. And so what happens with that is when that delta changes, when the price of Bitcoin goes sky high, but hash price hasn't changed as much, hash price, that is true. When it does try to catch up, you actually have this delta where all of a sudden your cost to produce those Bitcoins is still low, because the network difficulty hasn't caught up to the new price of Bitcoin for the most part. And so you have this crazy high delta where, okay, if we use that same example, Bitcoin's at 115, let's say it goes to 150 overnight for whatever reason. Your hash price, the cost that you're paying to produce those Bitcoins, is still at that $85,000. And now all of a sudden that delta between what you're producing at and the actual going price of Bitcoin is higher. And so what that means is you have a huge profit opportunity there, because you're producing Bitcoins at way less than the going market rate. And so over time, that mechanism actually allows for then, since you're acquiring them at that lower price, to have outperformance from just buying and holding. And there's a whole host of other factors that go into that. But again, the general gist is the tax depreciation benefits. You could, at the very least, offset a good chunk of your income in year one if you want to use bonus depreciation. You could potentially even offset other income. And the second big thing is you can acquire Bitcoin at a lower price. And due to that, if we have one of these big bull market scenarios again in the future, since you're acquiring at a lower rate, you could actually outperform just buying and holding spot Bitcoin as well. So that's, you know, that's not a guarantee by any stretch of the imagination, but there is the potential for it. And then the fourth benefit is just, yeah, kind of that cash flow piece of, okay, yeah, like now instead of, you know, you've got like an automatic DCA basically that is just happening for you versus you having to convert your fiat denominated dollars in, or even in the retirement scenario, hey, you know, mining Bitcoin could be a way you generate some income to supplement your spending along the way as well. So those are the big things. And as far as like, you know, do we recommend it? Not necessarily often, but it is something that we talk about with clients. Again, you know, to this Bitcoin expertise, like that's some of the value that we can bring to clients is understanding, you know, that market and kind of what some of the benefits are. But because it is a business and because, you know, there is risk, because there's also big risk that if you bought Bitcoin or you bought Bitcoin miners instead of just hodling Bitcoin, that you underperform just hodling, like it's not for everybody. So it's really, to me, it's kind of in the same vein of like the treasury company idea, right? Why do people want to hold treasury companies? Well, for the most part, they think that it probably can outperform Bitcoin, at least for some period of time. To me, it's the same thing with miners. This is like, yeah, it can underperform sometimes, but you do have the opportunity in certain market circumstances to outperform, and that can be attractive for that reason.
Okay. Got it. So before we wrap up, is there anything else that you, anything else on taxes? So outside of mining, are there any common mistakes or just sort of approaches that you try to take with Bitcoiners as they think about tax planning? I mean, I think obviously, especially if you've got a KYC stack, you're kind of, if you're, you know, buying and selling, you're paying capital gains. But is there anything else that maybe people don't think about?
I wouldn't say they don't think about, but some of the new tax law that came out at the beginning of the year as it relates to Bitcoin does provide some confusion for folks. Like, what in the world do I need to do here? Because they said, hey, I need to, you know, you need to like basically choose how you're going to do your taxes going forward as far as how am I determining what my capital gains are. And so that can provide folks some pause. But really what I tell people is, I mean, if you're acquiring Bitcoin, doesn't matter if it's KYC, non-KYC, whatever, you need to be tracking that. Like, even if it's just for your own good, if nothing else, you need to be tracking that somewhere else. So how much did I buy? When did I buy it? You know, what was the USD price at the time that I bought it? All those sort of things. It's a pain in the butt, and I get it, but it is necessary, especially in the when you go to sell, because what will happen is if you don't track that stuff, and especially if you're, you know, if you buy on an exchange, even a KYC exchange, you take it off exchange and then later you put it back on the KYC exchange and sell it, they don't know what your basis is on that Bitcoin. And so if they don't know what your basis is, you have to have some way to substantiate what it is. And again, there's different mechanisms of how that happens. Could be, you know, FIFO, first in, first out. So the first Bitcoin you acquired is the first Bitcoin you sold. LIFO, last Bitcoin you acquired is the first Bitcoin that you sold. HIFO is highest basis Bitcoin you acquired is the first that you sell. And you can even do, especially if you're tracking it, a specific lot ID, which is where you could just basically pick and choose which lots you're selling when you were selling Bitcoin. But the premise of that, you know, the tax laws, all that, it's confusing because they basically said you have to make some determination of which one of those methods you're going to use. But if you're not selling Bitcoin, like, it doesn't matter. So the thing that does matter is tracking it across time, even if it's for your own benefit and just understanding, hey, here's my actual performance on the Bitcoin that I've acquired across time. But certainly in those circumstances of, okay, yeah, I need to sell this for whatever reason. Okay, you either are going to have something that justifies and establishes that basis, or the exchange is just going to use zero, right? So that's not a great outcome if that's what they do.
Okay. So Jacob, you have provided a wealth of information here. So don't take this the wrong way, but nothing makes me more excited for a hyper Bitcoinized world where Bitcoin is legal tender than talking all of these concepts that hopefully someday people won't have to think so hard about. So no, man, I appreciate it. I do have one last question for you though. I warned you it was coming. And that is, what is an unpopular opinion that you have? You get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with it.
Yeah. My unpopular opinion is that gold is actually a better form of money than what Bitcoin is. The only reason that gold failed as a money, well, two reasons, is because of the velocity of gold. The gold was limited by natural law to have a low velocity, and so could not fulfill the function of money in modernity, because we need to be able to transport money across time and across space quickly, effectively, all that sort of stuff. But I still think that gold is a better form of money because it more, to me, I think it more closely follows natural law than what Bitcoin does, meaning that gold is a physical substance that we have to pull from the ground. There are natural, real world restrictions to that. And I understand people might apply that to Bitcoin and say, well, electricity is real world and all that sort of thing. But it was still a man-made protocol, basically, in the mechanism in which we do that, the timing in which we do that, the how in which we do that, versus gold is a God-given substance in the soil itself. And so there's good reasons that gold isn't money today. But I do still think it's a better form of money in many, many regards as compared to Bitcoin. But it just can't be used today because of the velocity. And some people will say, well, that's why it's not a good form of money. It's like, yeah, I get that. And so this is more a hypothetical than it is maybe a reality situation. But, I truly do believe that. Those charts that you see, with Bitcoin, where it's like the attributes of money, right? So the portability, the verifiability, the scarcity, all that other sort of stuff. One thing they never include on that chart is physicality. So if physicality means, is it a physical money that we can touch and actually, touch and pass to somebody else? And I think that portion is a big portion. Like, Bitcoin doesn't make sense to a lot of people because we don't have that. It is not intuitive, even in our digital age, to have a purely digital money. And so I think for that reason, too, that's another thing. Like, it's never included on that chart, but that's a big component of what makes money good. And again, the reality is that gold had physical limitations that don't allow it to fulfill on, maybe every promise that money should fulfill on in modernity. And that's why we now need Bitcoin. But I think the follow on to that too is that just when I look at gold and when I look at Bitcoin, I see something similar in that I see that they're both really good forms of money, but they're both susceptible to the same downfalls, which is human nature. And so the real reason that, gold and saying, it doesn't have good velocity and all that sort of stuff. Well, that really wouldn't matter if we as humans weren't so sucky, right? Like, it has a low velocity. So that means that we needed to create banknotes and all this other sort of stuff. Well, if we could have a fully honest and a fully trusting society, that wouldn't matter. Okay, great. Yeah, have banknotes, right? And it can be known, those banknotes are backed by gold. But because we are fallible human beings, we said, we have this mechanism. We're going to exploit this to the maximum that we can in fractional reserve banking, right? And Bitcoin is susceptible to that same thing. Bitcoin is susceptible to whatever our human nature can impart on it. I know people say, well, it's a protocol and, it's outside of that. It's decentralized, et cetera, et cetera. And sure, all that's true. But gold's decentralized too. It comes from the ground. Like it's really not that different to me, the two mechanisms. And I think that's something that Bitcoiners need to, worry about, or not worry about, but think about, is just understand how the decisions that we're making, how we're utilizing Bitcoin, not utilizing it, how we think about it, how we talk about it, those are going to have an impact on it across time, the same as what happened with gold. There'll be something in the future, we already saw it with the block size wars. Like, there's going to be something in the future, whether it's quantum computing, whatever else, I don't know. that is going to have that same mechanism that is going to say, hey, yeah, human nature is going to be imparted on this in some form or fashion. We need to understand what that means both now and over the long term, right? I mean, the people that had the first banknotes, they probably couldn't even fathom a world where fractional reserve banking to the extent that we have now was even possible because the people back then wouldn't have allowed it. So gold is a better form of money. It's also susceptible to human nature. Bitcoin is too. We need to be aware of that. I don't know if that's will get too many people teed off or not, but that's my baby.
I think that might be the most unpopular opinion you could have shared. I think you just took the cake. We're, 76, 77 episodes in at this point. I think you are going to piss the most people off with that opinion. You're a sentimental man to believe in that about gold. I would say, first of all, respect you, love our conversations. I couldn't disagree with you more. To me, like the analogy I would say is if I learned how to fly right now, the equivalent would be saying, yeah, but a horse is physical and your ability to fly isn't physical. I mean, I can see you flying, but like, I can't touch your ability to fly.
Really?
I think that money is a matter of a handful of properties that you evaluate, into your point, scarcity, all the charts you see about gold. I don't think physicality makes something better money. I think it makes it useful in certain contexts because a lot of the gold bugs point to industrial and, aesthetic application of gold and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But I think I do agree with you on susceptibility to human nature. And I think that will be true of any money ever to exist for the rest of time. If the sun burns out in 4.5 billion years, I think there's always the human nature risk of effectively anything. So, but hey, I appreciate you bringing honesty to the conversation. I will be curious to see what people say in the comments. This will be a fun one to keep tabs on.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Really enjoyed it, Mikey.
Good. Well, hey, why don't you give people a handoff? Tell them where they can find you online. Tell them about Strong Wealth.
Yeah. So we've got a firm, Strong Wealth. You go to strongwealth.net. It's me and my business partner, Mitch. We run that. You can find us both on X. I think he might be on Noster. I can't remember off the top of my head. But my Noster is just my name at Albi. My name at primal.net. And then on X, I'm at ColBitRun, ColBitRun. So that stood for Colorado Bitcoin Runner. That was when I ran a lot more, which I don't do anymore. So I don't post a lot on X, but you can follow me if you'd like. But yeah, you can find us at Strong Wealth and love to talk with anybody who wants to talk or debate why gold sucks and Bitcoin is the best. So.
I love it, man. Well, I'll link to all of that in the show notes, but thank you so much for your time, brother. We'll catch up again soon.
Yep, you bet.
Cheers. And that's a wrap again. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jacob. Always fun to catch up with him. He's an awesome guy. Really appreciate what he and Mitch at Strong Wealth are doing. Go check out their website. Go follow them on X, Noster, wherever else you can find them. I think you'll enjoy that. And of course, if you need help with taking your Bitcoin into 100% self-custody, if you need help with estate planning, this possession aspect of inheritance planning that we were discussing, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We can help you do it right. We can help train your heirs. We can cover all of those fundamentals. And then of course, the Strong Wealth team can help you with possession, legal title, if that's a path that you desire. We also help with online privacy, setting up privacy phones. We have a Plan B residency option. We can even help you set up a solo miner so you can get mining and playing the lottery every 10 minutes. Again, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast, schedule some time with a member of our team. We can talk you through everything. Do me a favor, if you're enjoying the show, if you enjoy this channel, give us a like, subscribe, comment, share it with someone. We would really appreciate you helping to feed the algorithm, of course. And until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.